So nice to have you back, Ambassador Freeman.
Glad to be with you, Nima.
And let's get started with what's going on between Israel and Hezbollah right now. We had a new type of different attacks on Hezbollah with these pagers, walkie-talkies, and electronic devices. And right now they're bombing the southern part of Lebanon. And how do you find the conflict? And first of all, how did you find this attack, this type of attack that we haven't seen before?
Well, it's a very disturbing development. In addition to being indiscriminate and therefore a gross violation of international law, and a violation of basic rules of human decency, it has escalated things, and it's clearly, in my view, it was intended to disrupt the communications within Hezbollah, even at the expense of killing or maiming civilians, in order to prepare for an attack on Lebanon. Because if you can degrade the enemy's communications, you have immediately an advantage on the battlefield. The reaction from Hezbollah has been appropriate, honest. Yes, we suffered a grave setback. Yes, we have security problems we need to address. And yes, Israel has crossed a red line, which we will meet with new measures. But what those are, we don't know. One has to assume, by the way, one of the victims was the Iranian ambassador to Beirut, who had one of these pagers, which Israel apparently intercepted somewhere between the point of manufacture and the point of delivery to Lebanon. Hamas was not the only group that had these pagers. They were fairly widely dispersed in Lebanese society. And the walkie-talkies that were ignited the day after were actually mainly, I believe, in the hands of medical personnel, that is, hospital workers, doctors, nurses, and the like. And this just underscores the grave violation of international law and decency that this represents. And I suspect it has probably erased whatever last respect for Israeli decency may have existed internationally. I note that in the Western press, which is, of course, dominated by pro-Israeli narratives, when Hezbollah is referred to now, they're no longer called a terrorist group. And in fact, they aren't. They are a resistance. They were formed in response to Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982 and occupation of southern Lebanon. They've grown to be the most influential political party dominant in Lebanon. They are, in my view, having encountered them, fascist in the sense that they are a state within the state. They provide services to their members, which the state cannot provide. If you get up at 1 o'clock in the morning in Beirut, you might find Hezbollah orderlies sweeping the streets. This is something they do as a public service. And they provide assistance to the victims of Israeli aggression. So this is an important development, but we don't know where it is leading. And I have to assume that there are intensive negotiations or discussions now going on between Tehran and Hezbollah, possibly in Syria rather than in Lebanon, where security is somewhat better, obviously. But this has been deeply unnerving, no doubt, to Hezbollah and to the resistance generally, because it illustrates the extent to which Israel is prepared to act innovatively and break all the rules. A final note, we should all be concerned that we're not going to be allowed to take our cell phones onto airplanes anymore. If Israel did this to the Lebanese, there are going to be security ramifications that go through the world. And I remember coming back from a visit to the Bahamas, where I grew up, at Miami and being astonished to discover that the so-called shoe bomber had resulted in a requirement to take your shoes off to get on a plane. You know, and so every time we board a plane now, we offer obeisance to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, not out of respect, but because of the bureaucratic reaction to that. And I think a similar reaction will be coming to the vulnerability of electronics, whether they are computers. Or apparently, this particular explosive was undetectable in pagers, which would go through airport security with impunity. The same thing can be done to computers. It can be done to iPhones, to Android phones, to other phones. Maybe the main beneficiary of this will be Huawei, which isn't part of the Western network and fairly hard for Israel to reach into. But I don't know. Anyway, it's a very significant development. And it, as I said, it presages an Israeli assault on Lebanon, which, in fact, Defense Minister Gallant has been talking about rather openly.
Is Gallant changing his position toward Netanyahu, or his? Because it seems that he's changing his position.
He's had a severe break with Netanyahu, who I think wants to get rid of him. The price of that would be to agree with a small party in the Knesset, to have them join the coalition. That doesn't seem to have worked out yet. Gallant, although he is opposed to Netanyahu's policies in Gaza and accuses him of neglecting the hostage issue and also of indifference to the terrible stress on the Israeli armed forces, has apparently temporarily patched up his differences with Netanyahu. Perhaps the price of that will be the murder of many people in Lebanon.
And in your opinion, the reason of this conflict, this new wave of attacks, was because of these Israelis that they want to send them to the northern part because they want to make some sort of disconnection between these, some sort of problem with the communication within the Hezbollah forces?
Well, I think the motives are multiple. Because this is an unruly coalition in the cabinet. There are some there, religious fanatics who want to annex part of southern Lebanon and who've been quite open about that. So they will treat southern Lebanon, if they are in charge, in the same way that they have treated Gaza. In other words, genocidally, with mass murder. In order to produce an area that Israelis can settle. But there are other people in the cabinet who are less bloodthirsty, less fanatical, whose motive is clearly related to the 60,000 or so Israelis who've been displaced from their homes in northern Israel by the exchanges of fire between the Hezbollah forces in Lebanon and the Israeli armed forces. Of course, we have to remember that this battle along the exchanges of gunfire and rockets along the border of Israel and Lebanon began when Hezbollah, out of sympathy and support for Hamas and for the suffering of the people of Gaza, joined in putting pressure on Israeli forces there. And that was the origin of it, and Hezbollah has always said that if the Gaza situation can be settled, they will halt their attacks. That is the prerequisite for a ceasefire. It's very clear that Israel doesn't want a ceasefire. It wants to take advantage of the war in Gaza, the presence of the U.S. 6th Fleet off its shores, the momentum that it has in exterminating Palestinians in Gaza and evicting them from the West Bank, to try to do the same in Lebanon, to build a cordon sanitaire, a a demilitarized zone, if you will, or some kind of buffer zone in southern Lebanon. They've tried to do this before. That is, in fact, what led to the creation of Hezbollah. I defer to military judgments by people more expert than I, but many people believe that even with impaired communications within it, Hezbollah is more than a match for the Israeli Defense Forces. So this is going, there's another element here, of course, and that this is part of Netanyahu's long-term effort to ignite a war between Iran and the United States, to draw the United States into a war that Israel can't win by itself, but might win if America backs it.
It seems that the new president of Iran right now, he's smart toward the conflict. The way that he was reacting so far, it seems that he's not willing to escalate, even the leader of Iran, to escalate the conflict with Israel.
Well, Mr. Pezeshkian has a record of moderation on many fronts, not on the question of Israel's genocide of the Palestinians, but he is risk averse. He wants to build relations with the outside world, not pull them down, including relations with the United States and Europe. And he recognizes that if he acts rashly or too forcefully, this agenda would be derailed. And so he's cautious. But how long that caution can continue in the face of repeated Israeli provocations is uncertain.
Recently, we've learned that Lloyd Austin talked with Israelis that he said that if your main objective is a conflict with Iran, if you go in that direction, we're not going to help you. Do you think that's still the case?
He seems to be speaking his own mind more and more, by contrast with the fading Biden administration, which remains very belligerent on the subject of Israel and Iran. I think Secretary Austin is a realist. He has also been quite realistic about the situation in Ukraine. As the military, U.S. military have been generally. You may recall that General Milley, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, argued in the late summer, early fall of 2022 that Ukraine had done the best it could and it should negotiate a peace with Russia. That was overruled by the Biden administration. Now there is a battle in which apparently Secretary Austin is against extending permission to Ukraine to use long-range attack systems to fire deep into Russia, while Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, is, as civilians often are, more bloodthirsty than the military, and he's advocating a harder line. One looks at, I don't know if you want me to jump into Ukraine.
Yeah, go ahead.
But there was a meeting between Keir Starmer and President Biden a few days ago, and it was widely expected that at that meeting they would announce that they were giving Ukraine permission to use British long-range weaponry against Russia. That didn't happen. And if you look at the film footage of that meeting, you will see a very testy, obviously very frustrated, rather angry President Biden. So the question is, why didn't the permission that was expected to be given, why wasn't it given? And we don't know, but my speculation is that President Putin of Russia, having declared that such permission would produce what he called a state of war between Russia and NATO and the United States, privately, in a back channel message, explained to President Biden and Prime Minister Starmer exactly what a state of war might mean, or at least part of what it might mean, and that this was sufficiently deterrent and unnerving that they withheld approval. We're now facing another moment when Mr. Biden will meet President Zelensky of Ukraine at the UN General Assembly. And once again, it is expected that he will authorize the use of carrying out of long-range strikes into Russia. Of course, Ukraine is already doing this with drones, as they showed at the with the explosion of a arms munitions depot in Tver not long ago. But the difference is that the NATO long-range weapons, whether they're ATACMS or Storm Shadow or the French equivalent, require targeting by the United States and NATO from satellite information, require the use of the GPS system, require targeting to be done not by Ukrainians, but by NATO, US, or other specialists. And therefore, the level of involvement of NATO and the United States in any such attacks would, as President Putin pointed out, make this qualitatively different. So the question will be, if indeed such attacks go forward, what is the Russian response? I think the Russians will try hard not to go to the nuclear level, although they are in the process of revising their nuclear doctrine, presumably to lower the threshold at which they authorize the release of nuclear weapons. But I think they have many other options, including, for example, sabotage. That could be very effective for them, since one thing the war in Ukraine has proven, beyond any reasonable doubt, is that the West does not have the production capacity to continue indefinitely in a war of attrition. So that means there are several points within the US and NATO military-industrial complexes where the sabotage could cripple the war effort. And the question then is, if we are engaged in blowing up munitions dumps in Tver inside Russia, why shouldn't they blow up munition dumps in the West? So I think we've come to a very dangerous point at which what was called by Mr. Putin deliberately a special military operation, meaning a limited operation, runs the risk of becoming a generalized state of war. And if that is the case, that has technical and legal implications that most of us have forgotten. A state of war justifies martial law domestically, but it also justifies attacks on belligerents on the other side, on their home territory. So we are on the brink of testing the question of whether this proxy war, which has escalated increasingly as it went along, will now escalate into a more general war between NATO, the United States, and Russia, and whether that war can be kept below the nuclear level. So I don't know what, if anything, was said privately from Mr. Putin and Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, to the White House and to Mr. Starmer. But I suspect there was some very pointed warning conveyed.
The other part of this equation is the European Union. Can we understand why the United Kingdom together with France are so much in favor of the continuation of the conflict? Because they're in the neighborhood. That's the problem with their concept.
I think the motivations are a bit different. I think the British see this as affirming their connection to the United States. And of course, one must recognize that since Brexit, when they left the EU, they are no longer a helpful voice for the United States in the councils of the European Union. They have therefore lost influence and prestige in the United States. They are of lessened utility to the United States. They may see pursuing the right-wing American neoconservative agenda against Russia as a way of consolidating their support in for what was for a long time a so-called special relationship with the United States. I think the French have a different motive. They are trying to rally Europe and bring it together in a common defense policy, which would separate them from the United States, would require an alteration of NATO. I think they would very much like to see NATO removed from American command and have a European in command. And I suspect they have a candidate for that who is French and not German. So the contradictions in the European Union are very considerable and growing, especially given the economic strains that it is experiencing following the sabotage of Nord Stream 2 and the progressive deindustrialization of Germany and the non-viability of many European industries in the absence of cheap Russian energy. So Mario Draghi, the former Prime Minister of Italy and Finance Minister and a European community figure, has castigated the EU for its failure to reform and open. You know, it's a pretty devastating critique if you read it. I think the EU is at sixes and sevens, as we used to say. That is, it is divided internally. France is trying to seize a leadership role. It sees posturing tough in a tough way against Russia as doing that. And so its motivations are different from those. It is a very goalist vision that the French have, and it is a search for relevance. Perhaps you saw the impassioned outburst of Dominique de Villepin, the former foreign minister in France, talking about how France had made itself diplomatically irrelevant and arguing passionately that France should assert itself with respect to Ukraine, with respect to Gaza, with respect to other issues. And he was charging the Macron government with having failed to defend French prestige and global influence. So this is a very complicated question. It's driven partly by Macron's sense of desperation domestically, partly by divisions in the EU, partly by centuries-old French ambitions to lead Europe, partly by the decaying relationship between Paris and Berlin, partly by the confusion introduced by the Meloni government in Italy. Very complicated, and I'm sure we need, I can't explain it to you. You'll have to hire an AI to do that.
There is an interview recently with Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO. He was talking with the Times and the Time newspaper, and he said that there is no red line and we can cross all red lines and Russia would not react. And we had the same type of mindset. I don't know if you watched the interview that Colonel Daniel Davis did with General Ben Hodges. He said that Russia would not use nuclear.
Yes, in my response to that, to Danny Davis, who I think performed a useful service by airing those ridiculous opinions by General Hodges and others, was that, you know, these people also said that Russia was bluffing back in December 2021, while the intelligence community was saying Russia was going to walk all over Ukraine, and they were, you know, genetically predisposed to aggression against their neighbors. And therefore, nothing, you know, didn't matter what we did, they were going to attack Ukraine anyway. These guys were saying, no, Russia's bluffing, they'd never dare cross the border. And they were wrong. So was the intelligence community. Russia didn't walk all over Ukraine. Ukraine put up a very valiant and effective defense. I think they should have been fired from television back in 2021 or 22. And it's a shame that they're still spouting the same nonsense. Stoltenberg, I think, at that time, also, I mean, after all, he was the head of a military alliance. That military alliance was originally defensive, but it became offensive when it participated in both the Libyan operation and in Afghanistan, when it took Kosovo from Serbia. You know, it became an offensive alliance. And I believe that Mr. Zelensky, who is headed to New York, apparently to brief President Biden on his magical plan for Ukraine to take everything back from Russia, I believe that plan probably proposes NATO troops in Western Ukraine. That is to say, put your troops in Western Ukraine, far from the Russian border, and that will free our troops to go to the border and fight in the Donbass and, you know, reinforce the Kursk salient, which is shrinking as we speak. So that is, you know, a big step toward direct war. I don't see how you can avoid calling it anything else. And it's an act of desperation because Ukraine has very few men left, and the equipment it has been supplied with hasn't worked.
And we had an interview, Sikorsky had two Russian pranksters were talking with Sikorsky, the foreign minister of Poland. And in this talk, he said that NATO is not willing to put troops on the ground in Ukraine officially and to fight Russians. Can we get some sort of calmness out of this talk, out of this concept? As we know, he's pretty much in line with neocons.
Yes, but he's an intelligent, realistic man with a lot of experience. And while he is a Polish, he is a Pole, and the Poles are very anti-Russian and have a long history of either being invaded by Russia or invading Russia themselves. You know, and are therefore quite bellicose with relation to the Russians, and are with over 4% of their GDP devoted to defense, the standout military modernizers, with a lot of South Korean equipment in Europe. You know, therefore, you must take him seriously. And I think that's an intelligent judgment by an intelligent Polish statesman. You know, which belies the sort of cartoon version of the Poles, you know, that they're foolish and they can't wait to charge on their horses against Russian tanks. I had a friend who did charge on a horse against Nazi tanks in 1939 and ended up, fortunately for him, in the United States after the war.
Right now, there is a victory plan, Zelensky's victory plan, in which Le Monde reported one of the main points of this plan is an invitation from Biden to Zelensky in order to facilitate Ukraine being part of NATO. And they know if they can get it right now, nobody's willing to do this in the future after 2024 presidential election. Do you think Biden in his final days would do that?
I don't think he has the capacity or the power to do that. To join NATO, you must be approved unanimously by all NATO members. We saw that process play out with divisions between Turkey and Finland and Sweden as they joined. But more importantly, the essence of NATO is Article 5, which commits all members of NATO to react in accordance with their constitutional processes to an attack on any other member. And so when Poland joined NATO, some of us who were involved in that process reminded the Poles that the price they would pay was they would have to defend Portugal and be prepared to die for Portugal if Portugal experienced an attack. And Portuguese similarly must be prepared to die for Poland. This is a standard that people have pretty much forgotten, because for a long time, NATO was either unused militarily or in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War, it held all the cards. You know, how could Serbia resist the NATO operation against Kosovo? This was a case of a very large power against a smaller one, a tough one, but a smaller one. My point here is that we've now had 2.5 years of warfare in Ukraine, and the West and NATO and the United States and Poland, according to Sikorsky, I guess, have shown that we are not prepared to die for Ukraine. We are not prepared to make that commitment. We are not prepared to send our young men and women to die in a war against Russia over Ukraine. Therefore, the issue of NATO membership for Ukraine is moot. We have already demonstrated that we are not prepared to accept the obligations that would accompany Ukrainian membership. And furthermore, I think on the other side, Russia has definitively shown that it will not tolerate Ukraine in NATO, that it will insist on Ukraine returning to the neutral status it had after its independence and not joining a U.S. sphere of influence in Europe and not becoming a place where American and German and other weapons can be emplaced against Russia. So the Russians have shown they will not accept it. We have shown we will not do it. And so I think talking about NATO membership for Ukraine at this point is empty talk, intended to appeal to the diehard supporters of the war in Ukraine and to those who absurdly imagine that the United States, the President of the United States, Mr. Biden, can do whatever he wants internationally and get away with it. No, we have been given a lesson by the Russians that there are limits to what they will tolerate and limits to what we can do. And those limits are not going to go away. So you can't raise a magic wand and say, okay, Ukraine, you are now a blessed member of NATO, because there's no basis for that. I might note that there are other issues here. Ukraine is not a democracy now. Ukraine is under martial law. It has suspended its elections. Mr. Zelensky is in office unconstitutionally. The press in Ukraine is not free. The media are not free. Dissent is not permitted. Ukraine is suffering. I think we should all focus on how to enable whatever remains of Ukraine, at the moment 80% of it, how we can help that become a prosperous democratic buffer state between Russia and the rest of Europe, and how we can devise a European security architecture, as Mr. Putin proposed in December 2021, that threatens neither Russia nor the West. These are the tasks before us. Now, Mr. Putin has an additional objective, which he's basically accomplished by incorporating the Donbas into Russia, and that is the rights of the linguistic and ethnic Russian minority in Ukraine. He has not, however, solved the problem of Hungary and the 150,000 Hungarian Ukrainians who have equally been deprived of the right to use their language and perpetuate their culture by communicating with government in Hungarian or educating their children in Hungarian. The same is true of the Romanian minority and so forth. So Ukraine is in need of redemocratization. It is in need of a return to constitutional order. It is in need of a return to tolerance for diversity within Ukraine. And if there is assimilation to be done of minorities in Ukraine, it is going to happen by a natural process. It cannot be imposed by force, as the government in Kyiv began to do after the 2014 coup. Yeah.
It seems the way that they're asking to get an invitation from Biden is because they want to facilitate some sort of facilitation. They want to facilitate the process of being part of the EU. That's the main goal for them, in my opinion. And
well, it should be. But to enter the EU, you should ask the Turks how easy that is. Of course, in the case of Turkey, there is religious prejudice. There is a concept, particularly in France, of Europe as Christendom. And a Muslim member of the EU of any weight is therefore seen as a threat, a dilution of a European identity that is Christian. I think that is a very wrong-headed view, but I'm not European, and Europeans can decide what they want. But to join the EU, you must go through an accession process, which requires conforming to European standards of justice, the rule of law, respect for human rights, respect for the rights of minorities, and the end of conflicts with your neighbors. I mean, you have to settle your borders and agree to abandon claims to the territory of other states that they contest. This is how Hungary got in. You know, there was the Vojvodina area in dispute. Hungary, Romania, and others have reached a settlement as a part of the accession process. So this is not an easy thing for Ukraine, and especially not after a war. But Ukraine also needs physical reconstruction. The amount of damage has been huge, and it is getting worse, because for every escalation that Ukraine carries out with our help, Russia counter-escalates. And a Russian capacity to escalate well beyond what they have done is pretty obvious. So Ukraine has a choice. It can make peace now, or it can watch itself see its bargaining position continue to weaken as it loses still more territory and men. And I think the correct choice is a negotiation. Now, Mr. Zelensky in New York, he's trying to hold off Mr. Trump, who's already said that in the first 24 hours he will dump Ukraine, basically. And he's trying to commit Biden, who will be, he hopes, succeeded by Kamala Harris, to a particular course of action in the war. Whether Kamala Harris will feel bound by that is another question. But because she's been, you know, a little bit cagey on the subject. She's very much a hardliner, but, you know, she may or may not continue the Biden policy. So Ukraine faces a difficulty. Its international support, led by the United States, is uncertain. We're approaching the election. It's November 5th. I think this is already, September 20th, there's not much time left. So I think Zelensky is quite intelligently trying to nail down support from the United States. I would point out, however, that if Mr. Trump is elected, he's already in his first term in office declared that he's not bound by anything his predecessors ever did. So, he feels able to withdraw from treaties, break agreements, treat allies and adversaries with subject them to tariffs and sanctions and so forth. This is, Zelensky's in a corner, and I sympathize with him in a sense.
As you mentioned, we are approaching 2024 presidential election in the United States. Hillary Clinton recently was talking with MSNBC, pointing out about 2016 Russiagate. And she's just extending the concept to right now, what's going on right now in 2024, saying about pro-Russians, pro-Putin, all of these analysts. And I'm going to play a clip about what she said, just a small clip.
As Mueller indicted a lot of Russians who were engaged in direct election interference and boosting Trump back in 2016. But I also think there are Americans who are engaged in this kind of propaganda, and whether they should be civilly or even in some cases criminally charged is something that would be a better deterrence because.
Yeah,
that is disgraceful for anybody educated in a top rank American law school, as she was. The First Amendment gives us absolute right to say what our conscience dictates. If that happens to coincide with something somebody in a foreign country says, that is not any reason to try to apply civil or criminal remedies to speech. So this is very typical, I must say, of Mrs. Clinton. She's always been insistent that people around her join a tightly controlled team. And she's still litigating the election of 2016. There's no evidence that anything Russia did had any effect of consequence on our elections, none whatsoever. And the fact that the Russians tried to influence our election on issues of interest to them is normal international behavior. We do it all the time. So does your own country, Brazil. You know, you try to exercise influence to protect your interests. This is normal. And we all conduct public diplomacy, which consists of public statements and so on. Unfortunately, social media has made devious public diplomacy much easier. But Russia is by far the not the major practitioner of this. Anyway, she is unwilling to admit that she lost the 2016 election to Donald Trump. And she lost it fair and square. And of course, he doesn't admit he lost the 2020 election, which he did. So we have an unfortunate tradition arising in the United States in which the main virtue of democracy, which is the peaceful transfer of power between leaders, is now in question. We don't know whether the 2024 election, whoever wins it, whoever loses it, will accept that they lost it. You know, there's now the two precedents for constantly arguing that, no, I didn't, you know, it wasn't my fault. I didn't, somebody else did this to me. You know, this is typical human behavior. We never want to admit that we're wrong. It was always somebody else who made a mistake and put us in the terrible position we're in. You know, when the civil rights movement occurred in the southern United States, it was all due to outside agitators from the north. It didn't have anything to do with the condition in which African Americans were then living. So we assume we're right, everybody else is wrong. And if something bad happened, somebody else must have done it. This is, whatever it is, it is not very attractive.
Are we losing the tolerance within the policymakers in the United States and anybody who's criticizing them on some sort of policy toward Russia or China? They're just condemning them, like the way that Hillary Clinton was talking about these people who are Russian analysts, and they call it pro-Russian, pro-Putin. Because the way that we saw, even during Nixon, with Vladimir Syme, who was Russian, he was an advisor to Nixon. And right now they're talking about him the way that he's a Russian agent. And
well, Dmitry Symes is Russian, of course, very knowledgeable. He has moved back to Moscow after many years in an influential position in the United States, most recently as the head of the Nixon Center. He's a very gifted analyst. He's a very intelligent man. He has come to the conclusion that we're wrong on a number of issues in U.S.-Russian relations, and he's spoken out. He has that right. As an American citizen, he can say whatever he wants, wherever he wants to say it. This is all very familiar if you know American history. For example, during World War I, various states outlawed the teaching of German because the Germans were the enemy. We renamed various foods to avoid German terminology. People whose surnames were German anglicized them in order to avoid being branded as pro-German. I cannot tell you how many people surnamed Brown in the United States used to spell it A-U-N instead of O-W-N. So this is familiar. We seem to glory in this. Let's remember the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. And in fact, the kidnapping of Japanese, Italian, and German Americans from South America. A fair number of the people who ended up in the internment camps in the west of the United States had been abducted from Peru, where there was a significant Japanese population, illustrated, of course, by Mr. Fujimori, who just passed away, former president of Peru. And by the way, we abducted some people from Brazil, too, with the help of the military government. And so, you know, this is, I'm sorry to say, not America, the United States at its best. It does not reflect well on us.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ambassador, for being with us today. Great pleasure.
Have a very pleasant afternoon, and look forward to seeing you again, Nima. Bye-bye.
See you soon. Bye-bye.